Good morning. I am not Stephen Wheatley. I'm Ann Kenny still, and welcome to the Academic Assembly, and also the beginning of reunion weekend. I'm really impressed by the number of libraries that are making their buildings and collections open for alumni who are here. We have to be nice to them in the hopes that they will be nice to us. So before I introduce our speaker, I want to do some announcements. Glenn Wiley, is Glenn here? Hi, Glenn. I'm Ann. Glenn Wiley is the new metadata librarian in metadata services. He received his BFA from Syracuse and his MSLIS in 2004, also from Syracuse. He was recently the digital resources and metadata librarian at Rensselaer Polytechnic in Troy, New York. So welcome. And you start today, right? You started Monday. All right. That was the only announcement that I had, but are there announcements from the floor? Elaine? Thank you, Elaine. Are there other announcements? Okay. Well, it's my distinct pleasure to introduce you to Steve Wheatley, who is the Vice President of the American Council of Learned Societies. I've been particularly impressed by what ACLS does and Steve's role there. And for those of you who have not had a chance to look at the ACLS's Commission on Cyber Infrastructure in the Humanities and Social Sciences, their final report was issued last fall on our cultural commonwealth, and it really is concerned with institutional innovations that will allow digital scholarship to be cumulative, collaborative, and synergistic. It's one of the key reports in a series of reports looking at cyber infrastructure research in various domains, and I recommend it highly to you. Steve, as the Vice President, has responsibility for programs in the administration of the Council's office. He is also staff to the joint ACLS Social Science Research Council International Program. I'm a beneficiary of that program as a member of the Working Group on Libraries and Archives in Cuba. So it's the hardship of having to go to Havana every February is something that I'm happy to bear. He also is responsible for the ACLS SSRC AIB Fellowship Program and the International Pre-Dissertation Fellowship Program. He's the ACLS manager of the American National Biography, a new 24-volume reference work in American history, which is also available in the online edition. And yes, Steve, we do have it. Before joining ACLS in 1986, Dr. Wheatley taught history at the University of Chicago, where he was also Dean of Students in the Public Policy Committee. He holds a BA from Columbia University and an MA and PhD in history from Chicago. He is the author of, among other things, The Politics of Philanthropy, Abraham Flexner and Medical Education. And yes, we do have it. So. We like to keep it that way. So today he will be talking about the new kaleidoscope of scholarly communication, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you all for coming this morning, and I want to thank Eric for helping to organize this event. I have left this up for just a minute because Eric pointed out I had the same tie on as in our website picture. And I need to clarify that I own at least two ties. That one has colored rectangles. This one has white rectangles. Obviously, we need a better resolution in our digital photographs, but I have now the uncomfortable question that I'll have to bring up with my therapist of why I only have one style of ties, let alone why I need to wear ties constantly, and especially in this beautiful weather. So let me see if I can then go to my presentation, which is also rather rectangular. But, okay, view show. Okay, well, I want to do three things today, and I hope I can do them quickly enough so that we can resume some discussions that started before we convened. First, I do want to, the center of my presentation is to talk about our cyber infrastructure report, our cultural commonwealth, which we hoped would provide for the scholarly community as a whole, for universities, for funders, for learned societies, for libraries certainly, and also for university presses and publishers, a framework and vocabulary for thinking about the potential of digital technologies for transforming scholarship. But two, I also want to put that report in a historical context of discussions of scholarly communication, and that context is a series of ACLS reports going back to 50 years almost to 1959. And that provokes the question of what is ACLS and why are we so interested in these things? ACLS is a federation of learned societies, of scholarly organizations, originally 13, now in 1919 when we were founded, now 69. So we represent scholars as scholars and are concerned with the research enterprise, which clearly then touches on the issues of scholarly communication. So scholarly publishing, research libraries, all these clusters of issues have been of concern to ACLS and colleague organizations for some time. So that's the second thing I hope to do, and that's the point actually where I'll begin. And the third is to just talk about some developments that have been subsequent to our publication of our cyber infrastructure report, developments which I think help emphasize how there are some important changes taking place in how scholars, at least, think about the relationship of the research enterprise to the enterprise of scholarly publishing. The reports that I'll cite have a great deal of continuity in their rhetoric, in their form, and even in their analysis. But they also, I think we can also apprehend a certain change in how the sometimes called crisis of scholarly publishing has been conceived. This crisis has been going on since the 1950s, so it's a sort of long-standing crisis, but perhaps the crisis needs to be redefined. And that's what brings me to the metaphor of my title, the new kaleidoscope. If we think of scholarly communication as a system for the production, distribution, validation, preservation, and retrieval of scholarly efforts to represent knowledge, that system has been fairly stable over time. It includes scholars, who produce the representations, learned societies that play a critical role in, we hope and believe, in their validation and certification as works worthy of note and preservation, university presses, which publish and distribute the work, but also play a critical role in peer review and the certification of scholarship that's crucial for career advancement. Research libraries, obviously, for the preservation and accessibility of knowledge, and, of course, dollars, which makes it all possible. But and since the emergence of the modern university in the United States, this system has been relatively stable despite the continual feeling of crisis surrounding it. Indeed, it's something of a venerable system, and if we think, which leads me sometimes to think of it as a stained glass window, something that has a picture and a narrative and different actors within it. I think what's happened, though, is this system has not only been under strain, but especially with the development of digital technologies and network information, there's been a, I don't think it's too strong to say, a sort of shattering of the window. We have new forms of knowledge production, not simply the individual scholar producing the monographic work. We have new objects of scholarship, not just books and articles, but more complex constellations of databases with commentaries that we don't quite have a simple name for. We have new forms of scholarly of publishing and distribution, new forms of preservation and retrieval. I don't need to tell the people in this room about those. And of course, we have new actors, Google being only the most prominent example. So hence the metaphor of a kaleidoscope, that instead of having a fairly stable system, which may be under crisis and strain, what you have is a slowly shifting but repatterning system where the actors are, if not changing roles, changing some of their relationship to each other. And that, I think, is the basic message of my talk this morning, which is that the questions regarding scholarly communication over the past 50 years have changed, or at least a new question has been added. When I look back over the older reports, I see a persistent question of how technology can empower, can help, can solve some of the problems of the extant system of scholarly communication, how it can help university presses be more efficient, how it can help libraries with cataloging and bibliographic work, questions of accessibility. Now I think we have an additional question, which is how the system of scholarly communication and its actors, if we twist the kaleidoscope, can accommodate these new forms of knowledge production and knowledge representation that are made possible by digital technologies. And we're only at the beginning of knowing what can be made possible, what might be made possible. The whole point of developing a cyber infrastructure is to build a platform for exploration and experimentation. And we don't know what will come of it, and that's both what's exciting and challenging. Now, you'll also notice, of course, that I have a PowerPoint here, and I will struggle to walk back and forth between my notes and the PowerPoint. If power corrupts, PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. While it may help with the presentation and organization of thoughts or with note-taking, it certainly... there's our cultural commonwealth, and as Anne correctly said, it was published in 2006. But PowerPoint does detract from the rhetorical lift of some presentations, and also eviscerates their literary value. So even if the points are clear, some of the emphasis may be missing, so I hope you'll excuse me with that. That was an earlier presentation. So to turn to the first of this list of ACLS publications, this was Problems of Scholarly Publishing in the Humanities and Social Sciences, which was issued in 1959. It was motivated by the, whoops, 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 See, PowerPoint is already working against us. It was motivated by the perception that the growing explosion of knowledge in the post-war university, then having an efflorescence thanks to the GI Bill, thanks to the promotion of language and area studies by foundations and the federal government and ACLS and SSRC, the explosion of knowledge was being difficult, was having trouble funneling into the system of scholarly publishing. So we see in this report what we have heard repeatedly every decade since then, that there is a crisis of scholarly publishing, good work is going unpublished, there's problems in the allocation of subsidy, financial strain on presses that impede their efforts. What's, I think, interesting about this report is it was subsidized, the report itself was paid for with a grant from U.S. Steel. This was a time when there was a much more cohesive sense of responsibility among the corporate, philanthropic, and governmental elite for the university system and scholarly publishing, which was a part of it. This report undertook, like so many reports we're familiar with, quickly was a survey of scholars, a survey of university presses to try and ascertain what was the situation. And it found that the worries were slightly overstated, that scholarly publishing, well, first as a premise, that scholarly publishing cannot be expected to be self-sustaining, that subsidy is an inherent part of the process. And that's a premise that I think we can knit on our samplers and put on our walls today. It is certainly true. But they also concluded that the uncomplicated manuscript, especially in larger fields, of good quality could find a publisher, that there's not a crisis of scholarly publishing in the sense of aspiring scholars being thwarted in their career or intellectual ambitions. At the same time, there was a recognition that certain types of manuscripts would have difficulty finding a publisher, even sometimes with a subsidy. These were highly specialized manuscripts in narrow fields. An interesting category, work that is too long as an article and too short as a book. Already people were realizing that the article book dyad can be something of a set of handcuffs on scholarly creativity. Book using specialized or expensive materials, illustrations, graphs, different forms of script. And, quote, what they call the scholarly tool work, things like concordances or dictionaries that are absolutely essential but don't have a consumer market but only have a market with libraries. Their solutions were basically two, and these are the two solutions that everyone comes back to even today. Technological solution, micropublication through microfiche or Xerox, and they spelled it with two capital X's and felt necessary to explain in a footnote what it was, that maybe there's an alternative form of publication that's different than university press bound paper ink publication that could accommodate this other track of, this other set of materials. And of course, funding. And here, they quaintly suggest, not quaintly, but accurately for their time, but not for ours, that philanthropic foundations can be the source of support for the scholarly publishing enterprise. I think this is not something we can resort to today. One of the besetting problems in my work in general, and I think in all of our work, is that American foundations, by and large, have stopped supporting the academic enterprise and certainly scholarly publishing and scholarly communication as a primary object of their work. They did that from their emergence in the early 20th century until about the 1970s. Henry Heald, who was president of the Ford Foundation in the 1960s, said the mission of the Ford Foundation to advance human welfare can, the best way of advancing human welfare is to invest in the American system of higher education. With the conspicuous exception of the Mellon Foundation, led by former Cornell president Don Randall, I don't think you'd find a leader of a major foundation who would say that today, and this is a besetting problem we all must deal with. A second report that looked that's worth noting, and I'm sure all these are in the Cornell University Library, and if not, they will be digitized and on a new website for ACLS that we'll be bringing out this fall, was a report on research libraries in 1967. And this took the sort of parallel view from the 59 report, which was that research libraries are faced with, I love the phrase, refractory problems that impede their satisfactory performance. Again, precisely because of the explosion of knowledge, the expansion of the enterprise of higher education, the growth of faculty, the growth in the numbers of faculty, and the increased requirement for faculty to publish in order to maintain their careers. The specific problems were an inadequate bibliographic apparatus nationwide so that scholars could know where and what material was available for their particular area of research, inadequate funding, and automation, which the bulk of the report deals with as, quote, both a problem and a promise. And I think here is one of the starting points where the research library, in acting on the promise of automation, computer technologies, begins to move from being perhaps a junior partner in the system of scholarly communication to becoming the site where new innovations can take place, because libraries of necessity embrace computer technologies much earlier than certainly university presses and learned societies, who are also important to scholarly publishing, and certainly well in advance, I think, of many scholars in the humanities and social sciences. Scholars' first encounter with the use of new technologies was through the library rather than directly through their own research. The recommendations of this report are fairly standard, that there be a national commission on libraries, which would coordinate acquisition and bibliographic policies, and that there be increased federal and private funding, again, foundation funding. A third report, now leaping ahead to the 1970s, was the report on scholarly communication, or the title Scholarly Communication. It was the report of the National Enquiry, capital N-E, which was formed at ACLS but as a separate corporate entity with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Ford Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. Again, a sort of broad cluster of support that you don't tend to find in the same shape today. And the Enquiry sought to take a systematic view and also saw the need for systematic change. So unlike the previous two reports looking first at scholarly publishing and then tangentially at libraries as consumers of it, or looking first at libraries and then how they related to scholarly publishing by presses and societies, this tried to take a more synoptic view. It was too motivated by the crisis persists, the widespread concern that a crisis in finance, and this was a university-wide financial crisis, was impeding both research libraries and the viability of scholarly publishing. But the conclusion was not simply that there needs to be more funding, but that there needs to be qualitative changes in the way materials are published, stored, and made available. Unlike the previous reports, it did not take for granted the static relationship or the static operations of the pillars of the scholarly communication system or their static relations with one another. And I'd just like to read a paragraph from its own longer view, its vision of the future, which both captures some changes that have happened and missed some others. It says, let us imagine a scholar, a historian or classicist or a philosopher, in an office or study working to understand some scholarly problem. He or she will, we believe, have books and paper and pens and pencils and a typewriter. But there will be other things too. The typewriter will be part of a computer terminal. The work, as it is written, will come out as typewriting on paper. and also will be stored in the memory of the computer. The scholar can enter revisions in the computer by giving simple instructions and have the revised version retyped by pushing a button. If information is needed on a particular problem, the scholar can, through the typewriter, ask the computer for a bibliography, which can be typed out, or flash up on a video display, then parentheses, on a television tube, attached to the typewriter. The typewriter clearly is their basic metaphor. Selecting an item of interest from the bibliography, the scholar may turn to a console in the corner of the office, something different, or maybe down the hall where a photo duplicating machine used to be, and summon up through a national network the images of the pages that are of the greatest interest. They can be read on the video screen, and if they are needed for further study, the scholar can push a button and get a printout of the pages required. If many pages are needed, perhaps a whole book, a telephone call to the university library will bring a photo duplicate or of the microfiche of the book that is stored there, print on demand, or the university library can get the microform from other sources. The scholar may go to the library to browse among books. There will still be books, it emphasizes, and microforms, but the library will have assumed a major function as the electronic link between scholars on the campus and a national or even international network of information centers where writing is stored in many different forms, microforms, tapes, disks, electronic storage in computers, and books and journals. And I think this passage captures two important things that we tried to pursue in the cyber infrastructure report that I'm going to turn to in a minute. One is the importance of changing patterns of research. If you're going to look at the system of scholarly communication, it is important to look at the publishing, the distribution, the preservation, the access elements of the circle of scholarly communication. But it is also important to know what are the changing patterns of research that produce new forms of knowledge that need to be represented and published. It also, this vision, captures the basic idea that the problem of the future is managing abundance of information, not managing from scarcity of information in one particular location or one particular institution. If you read further, however, in this compelling vision, it begins to erode, or its prescience begins to erode a little. It tends to talk mostly about books, books in electronic form, books transmitted electronically, and not more, doesn't pick up on the idea that it mentioned in the last sentence, that there are international databases, that there are connections of information that's not necessarily captured or produced as a book. Also, it thinks about digital technology and this transformation as essentially an academic phenomenon, when I think what is really so interesting, compelling, and essential about the world we all find ourselves in is that digital technologies are a social phenomenon, a broad social, economic, and cultural phenomenon of which we are, in the academic world, as much on the receiving end as on the innovation side of it. So, and that brings us to these are the recommendations of the Scholarly Communication Commission, a national bibliographic system, a broader role for foundations, didn't happen, an NEH Office of Scholarly Communication, also didn't happen, ACLS, ARL, and American Association of University Presses setting up a standing commission on technology, actually that did happen, an office was created, and it couldn't find funding from the foundations whose broader role is invoked. So it closed in the mid-80s, an idea that was just right ahead of its time and not within it. So that brings us to the ACLS Cyber Infrastructure Report, which is available online, as well as, I'm sure, in the Cornell University Library. And as I said, this report was not primarily about scholarly communication, although it has implications for scholarly communication, but was about the potential for digital technologies to transform research in the humanities and what we at ACLS call the interpretive social sciences. It's about the question not what technology can do for scholarly communication, but raises the question of how scholarly communication can accommodate new possibilities. Briefly, who were the who of the commission? I served as staff, but the commission members are the people who really produced the report. John Unsworth, the dean of the Library and Information Science School at the University of Illinois, served as chair. And he picked the other members of the commission, not for their representativeness, because they represented particular institutional sectors, but because they were people who were experienced, had a breadth of experience with the transformative quality of digital technologies. There was a wide network of advisors that included Deanna Markham, now of the Library of Congress, then of the Council of Library and Information Resources, Cliff Lynch of the Council for Networked Information, and many, many others. The direct inspiration for the report was the NSF report issued in 2003, which, if it didn't coin the term cyber infrastructure, helped give it considerable currency. This report is often called the Atkins Report after its chair, Dan Atkins, who served as an advisor to the ACLS report and now heads the NSF Office of Cyber Infrastructure, which I think we all can hope will be one of the most important nodes for advancing this transformation of the way knowledge is reaped and presented. And we can even hope not just for the hard sciences, but for the general academic enterprise. This report gave evidence of how digital technologies were transforming the way science were practiced. It mobilized not only scientific interest, but interest in the harder social sciences, the more quantitative and model-driven social sciences, and NSF issued a parallel report on those fields. So together with the ACLS report, we now have one of the first times in recent memory, all areas of the arts and sciences focused on a particular set of questions, the building of cyber infrastructure and the transformation of research patterns in a way that we hope can engage university leadership and leadership of funders. That's the potential of cyber infrastructure. These new information technologies can empower research, certainly on traditional objects of study. Indeed, many of the, and I'm sure as many in this room are aware, in the humanities, some of the leaders, the earliest adapters to digital technologies, were the people who are in some of the most traditional fields with the most traditional objects of study, archaeologists and classicists. For archaeology, digital technology has the potential to regather and reconstruct virtually material objects, or at least images of material objects, that are now scattered around the world. If you know the cuneiform project at the University of California at Los Angeles, it takes objects from throughout Mesopotamia that were once located within Mesopotamia but are now in museums around the world and brings them together in one site examination and documentation and inquiry by scholars. Classicists have also been leaders digitizing materials, possibly because they have many fewer problems with intellectual property than other fields. They have all the books they're going to get. I mean, and they don't have to worry. The moving wall they've moved way beyond it. But we have considerable evidence of how digital technologies empower scholarship as traditionally practiced. But for me, the most compelling reason for the humanities to have a cyber infrastructure, to have a platform for retrieving, understanding, and representing knowledge in a digital form, is because if the humanities is about human creativity is increasingly born digital. No one could write a history of the visual arts in the past decade without including YouTube or visual culture without including YouTube, without including websites. You couldn't write a history of politics or an analysis of politics without including the blogosphere. If the humanities in particular are not to be an antiquarian science going forward, they are going to need to have the tools to preserve, document, analyze, and interpret human creativity, which is increasingly digital. What is cyber infrastructure? Again, it's a platform. It's not a set of research goals. It is a systems for the empowerment of specific communities of researchers. And I think this is a very important point. It is not meant to predetermine how scholars make their inquiry. That is what, quote, in the NSF terms, domain scientists do. Cyber infrastructure is something of a middle layer of discipline-specific software, of expertise, of best practices, of tools, of collections, of policies, and of environments. It's what libraries are increasingly presenting in all their breadth to their faculty. To become a site for research and interpretation, and not simply the way past knowledge is preserved. And this, in development of the report and in conversation with scholars, was a hard point to get across, the very idea of cyber infrastructure. When we first started to develop the report, mention of that polysyllabic word would bring a certain snickering to the room. And I think that was indicative of a problem that many scholars in the humanities have, which is that mentally they have so naturalized the existing infrastructure of scholarship, libraries, museums, archives, and think of it as something inevitable and sustainable without question, that they don't realize that it is a structure that is constructed and needs curation and care. The report goes on to say that the cyber infrastructure will have some necessary characteristics, and these are meant to be sort of guides to people who allocate resources and make decisions. It should be accessible as a public good. Clearly, sustainability of collections of activities is a big issue. Interoperability, you don't want everything to be just a single parallel. The whole point is aggregation. It should facilitate collaboration, and it should support experimentation. The recommendations are incredibly straightforward. I'll go through them very quickly. Investment, it is about money. Developing policies that foster openness and access. The great potential of cyber infrastructure or of digital technologies and digital scholarship is both that it can see a wider array of materials than previously possible, and it can possibly bring new audiences to scholarship. Cooperation between the public and private sectors is essential, but all the money is not going to come simply from foundations and the government. Leadership is clearly essential. This is why we were trying to issue the report and hope to be working with ARL, with the Council of Library and Information Resources, and with others in carrying out efforts to acquire more information and reformulate these questions. To encourage digital scholarship, I'll say more about that in a minute, and to establish national centers, this is an issue NEH has taken up, that can support scholarship that contributes to and exploits the cyber infrastructure. These may be new digital centers like the Institute for Advanced Technology and the Humanities at the University of Virginia. They may be existing centers that have a digital dimension. The Inter-University Consortium for Social and Political Research at the University of Michigan is a big curator of huge digital collections and has a capacity to develop new ways of making that material accessible to scholars in the social sciences. The American Antiquarian Society, member of ACLS, is increasingly a digital collection of material. Develop open standards and robust tools, and create extensive and reusable digital collections. This is clearly the seedbed of the changes that will happen. Whatever comes of the Google project, there's going to be a lot of opportunity or need to develop specialized collections of materials that scholars will use, and to adjust whatever comes from mass digitization projects to particular scholarly needs. And let me quickly say, so we can move on to a discussion, what's happened since the report was issued. Under the heading of investment, it's very encouraging that the National Endowment for the Humanities has developed a digital humanities initiative, as drafts of our report were circulating. They formulated this new initiative. This is a departure for NEH, which for a long time had been quite standoffish to supporting digital tools, certainly, and to supporting digital projects. I have to say, just like all of NEH, this is not the fault of its current leadership, all of NEH is underfunded. This digital humanities initiative is underfunded. The president's budget had a big whopping $1.4 million for this initiative. We can hope that Congress is going to add to it, and we are lobbying toward that end. One very encouraging aspect of the NEH's initiative is it seeks to broker partnerships within the federal government. So one of the first is between IMLS and the NEH in a digital partnership, and this, at the federal level, reproduces the necessary partnership between scholars and libraries that is really the scholarly infrastructure, scholars, library, and museums, and that is very encouraging. Creating extensive digital collections. This is the Digital Preservation Program of the Library of Congress, NDIP. It was going on before. It's not a consequence of a report, but it's obviously one of the most important efforts in that direction. Encouraging digital scholarship. ACLS has set up a program of fellowships parallel to our core program that provides funds for scholars who have digital projects that add value to humanistic inquiry. Adapting the fellowship mechanism, which is traditionally just time off, to research that may involve its own infrastructure, its own piece of an infrastructure, specialized materials, is something of a challenge. The proposals that we get for fellowships often are essentially book proposals rather than project proposals that sequence a series of activities and talk about the infrastructure necessary to carry out those activities. So this has been an innovation in our own practice as well as encouraging digital innovation. What I'll report here that's so encouraging is the enormous demand for these fellowships. We have enormous demand for all our fellowships, an average ratio of 14 applicants for every award. The ratio here is 20 to 1. In an area that's relatively esoteric or relatively new, I think that's very encouraging and indicates that there'll be more and more demand for digital scholarship. But we come then to the question of credentialing, the question of peer review, the question of how people build a career. And many of you may be aware of this report, also funded as our cyber infrastructure report was by the wise and all-seeing Mellon Foundation. And this is a very detailed study of opinion within the University of California faculty about digital scholarship. And it reports that scholars are enthusiastic about using digital resources in their research, but tend to be wary about new forms of publication because they're not yet accepted as currency for scholarly credentialing. Books, again, primarily monographs, and articles remain the hard currency that can be converted to promotion and tenure. So this is, again, where the much-discussed crisis of the monograph, again, begins to come back. My own view, and I think the view of many others, is that the crisis of the monograph is as much a conceptual crisis about what scholarship is as an economics crisis about how scholarship is produced. And we're beginning to see some movement on that question. The Modern Language Association, the largest learned society in the humanities, had convened a task force for evaluating scholarship on tenure and promotion. It issued its report last year. It's on their website. And it said that the profession as a whole needs to rethink the conceptual crisis of the monograph. What is it doing? It is clearly a very valuable way of representing and reproducing knowledge, but it is not the only way, and that departments and institutions should recognize the legitimacy of scholarship, digital scholarship, and they should find ways of evaluating it. Basically, their answer to how do you evaluate digital scholarship is the Nike answer, just do it. It's your responsibility, departments, to decide on the validity of this work. Don't hand it off to university presses. Another important report, this one on art history, again funded by the Mellon Foundation by Hillary Ballin and Merritt Westerman, noted that, art history as a field has been very poorly served, or is having particular problems in scholarly communication because images are so expensive. It thinks there's a critical role for libraries to use digital technologies for more open access and research availability. And I call your attention to the second recommendation here, that university presses should think about knowledge dissemination and scholarly communication in areas that are not book publishing alone, and to connect some of their programs more closely to to universities and libraries. Well, where are the university presses? The many presses have embraced technological innovations in how they edit, produce, and distribute books. But I think they've, on the whole, been less active in exploring how scholarly publishing can accommodate new representations of knowledge. Most e-books tend to, and even in our the ACLS Humanities e-book project, most e-books tend to be e-versions of print books, albeit with the great advantage once they are networked in a collection of common searchability, which does reveal, does become a new way of reading. But born digital books that tend to have a new way of writing are not yet common currency within university presses. Ann and I were discussing this earlier, the AAUP feels very vulnerable on intellectual property and open access issues. You probably all know that they were quite hostile to the Google Library Initiative. They're very worried about federal legislation that would mandate open access in science and technology publishing and how that might come over into the humanities. And they were very disgruntled with, I think it's fair to say, with the ACLS report because they felt it gave short shrift to the economic impact of openness as a value on the viability of university press publishing. This statement, which is up on their website, I think is, aside from a gratuitous slam at our report, is a positive one, because in fact it says subsidy is the issue. Everything that is done in the university and in scholarly communication is subsidized. If open access may require a reallocation of subsidy, but it needs to be discussed. So quickly, in conclusion, I'd say that nothing is concluded. The nature of the discussion, though, has been transformed. There are lots of things in play, many things that are happening, but I think it's absolutely certain that libraries are going to become ever more central to scholarly communication as publishers of the more complex and different set of works that can't be accommodated by university presses, as together with university presses, we were discussing this earlier, publishing works that don't find any sort of market in the traditional business plan of university presses, and as hosts or gateways to the more extensive collections, which will be the seedbed of the new forms of research and knowledge representation. So let me stop there. I've gone on a little longer than I intended, but I hope we have a few minutes for any questions, comments, or objections. Everything, as Richard Nixon said, it was perfectly clear. Yes?
We all had a few good chuckles with some of the previous reports. If you could transport yourself to the distant future, say, 5, 10 years,
Yeah. Oh boy.
I mean, based on the fact it's a year old.
Yeah.
Almost a year old. Where do you think things are? Basically, the question is, where do you think things are moving? Where do you think things are?
Well, I think. Well, I think if there's. The way things are moving is to a much more, I hate to use the Tom Friedman word, but flattened system. Again, if you think of, you know, a series of parallel pillars, I don't think that's how scholarly communication is going to work so much in the future. You know, presses, societies, libraries, all holding up this arch. I think it's going to be a much more complex ecology. Because it's going to be more complex, I think that there's the funding system is going to be much more complicated. If there is a valid charge against our report, it's that it was conceived as a brief for funders, in particular federal funders. And I hope that there will be more and more federal support for digital research. I don't think there's likely to be federal support or major foundation support beyond the Mellon Foundation for scholarly communication. So I think we probably underdid the role of universities and, for that matter, research libraries in finding new vehicles for bringing to get for networking within that complicated ecology. Anne. I think my example, my poster child would be the University of California Press and the California Digital Library. I think that the UC Press was one of the first in developing an online capacity and not seeing that as a zero-sum game with their print capacity. The California Digital Library is working on developing scholars' toolboxes for use of examining collections, whether they're collections of archival material or visual material or collections of network books, as in the UC Press's system. And they cooperate quite closely. Obviously, the National Academies Press, which is not related to a particular library, was one of the pioneers in having open access to its publications, and they've seen no diminution in their print sales. Clearly, the relationship, not just of libraries and presses, but of digital aggregators and learned societies, has been particularly important in the case of JSTOR. I think that within my community of learned societies, it was the first time many societies and societies had thought about the role that scholarly publications plays in their business model at the same time it plays in their mission to advance knowledge. And that's the dilemma that they find themselves. Many are dependent upon journal revenues and are worried that changes in journal subscriptions will affect their viability. At the same time, their mission is to distribute information and as widely as possible. Yes? I might throw that question back at you. I mean, I do. I mean, I think part of the my impression, and you're much closer to it than I, is that the role of libraries as the conservators of physical materials and the need to, in one location, hold the broadest possible array of physical materials is declining. I mean, I first met Anne at a CLIR group that came to Cornell about it had the name Task Force on the Artifact, even less mellifluous than cyber infrastructure. The artifact being the physical object in a library's collection, and how libraries could find a way to collectively maximize the preservation nationwide or worldwide of that preservation without making it a local burden for everyone. So, I mean, I think the transformation of libraries as portals to a wider way of information and places where tools are developed to make that information, tools are deployed and presented that make that information accessible, is on the rise, whereas the preservation of and conservation of particular physical materials may be on the decline. But I know there are a lot of people who would really object to that and think saying that is advocating book burning. But what would you say? What's the zero sum? I mean, it's easy to say, well, more resources will solve all the problems. Go ahead. Well, I think that's a key development that we're waiting to congeal, that if not replace the book, become parallel to the book, or become more and more important vehicle for recognized vehicle for presenting scholarly knowledge. Ed Ayers, who many of you know was Valley of the Shadow Project history at the University of Virginia, is now becoming president of the University of Richmond, said at a meeting we had that you've got to go mono to mono with the monograph. I mean, that is something that is having an intellectual stranglehold as well as impeding the production, experimentation with new forms. It's something between it's not a website, and it's not simply a digital collection of primary materials. There's people, and again, in our History eBook Project, there are people who have written books, analyses of digital collections that have a dynamic relationship. There's, I can't get the exact title right now, but Ben Cole of Vassar College has written a treatment of a database of Venetian records that helps explain issues in transformation of the Venetian elite and how they interacted. And what it has is a set of tools in which you can interrogate these records and come up, you know, map the relationships among families and who's stabbing who in the alley and what's going on. So that I think in the future there'll be more and more of these digital publications that have commentaries, analysis, and sort of open-ended tools that then link to larger collections from archives or numerical databases. But they're not single freestanding entities. They are fundamentally networked. And we don't have names for that sort of thing. If we call them commentaries, it sounds potentially to a promotion and tenure committee as less important than a book, a thesis, an article. Yes. It's rising, but it's and I think the MLA report is going to help catalyze that, and I. But it's slow, and there are a couple problems. I mean, one, there simply is the process problem. People say, well, how do I get at this? How do I distribute it to the committee? People don't like to read on the screen. I think that's all eroding. Second, there's a big problem, and this is the problem of collaborative work. Part of the problem with the monograph is that it's the single author, and part of the problem in the humanities is that the tradition of collaborative work, once quite strong, has eroded. And people don't know how to assign value to that. They tend to think, I think inaccurately, that collaborative books, a book with two authors, or a work with two authors, is each did half the work, whereas people who do collaborative work will tell you it's twice the work to work with someone else, but you may get twice as good a product. So I think it is rising. For a long time, everyone was waiting for the scholarly equivalent of the killer app in technology, the really blockbuster work which would transform how everyone saw scholarship. My own field is American history. It's something like, you know, Frederick Jackson Turner's The Influence of the Frontier in American History. Suddenly, everyone looks at how you do research in a new way. I think it's going to be much more a process of accretion rather than that sort of blockbuster. But I think it is building. Yes? Here I'll draw mostly from my guide to this is Don Waters of the Mellon Foundation, which is that you need to, this is my opinion, and the council has no corporate position, but that we're not going to build a cyber infrastructure without cooperation from profit-making entities. That, you know, Google being, you know, just one example of places that have great technological innovation, and that there's an area where you can find common cause. But there are many corporate entities that are interested in buying up material and then selling it back to libraries for rental. And I think it is important that the academic community have sovereignty over its own productions. It's not going to be a problem for the German language text monographs that no one really wants, or the German studies monographs that no one wants to publish, but there is a potential worry that there are large aggregations of material that can't, that you wind up paying high rental fees for.
Shy of legislation.
My impression is that the legislative energy has ebbed, that Lieberman is not going to push his bill and Cronin is not going to push it. Short of legislation, I think there is got to be a combination of market mechanisms that provide for some sustainability and efficiency with accessibility, which may not mean everything being absolutely free, but it being accessible at a reasonable, in some way. I mean, the New York Times is, to my mind, accessible. The cost is reasonable. You can get part of it on the web, or you can go to libraries and get it. Kevin Guthrie, the first head of JSTOR and now the head of Ithaca, says this is the most difficult combination, is to find a way to promote accessibility and still have sustainability. So I don't have a formed opinion about that. I know within our societies there is a great need for, or desire, worry and desire about experimentation. The American Historical Association has tried ungating its digital articles, current articles, on the assumption that most scholars want to get at the reviews. So they'll continue to pay for the reviews, but they can ungate the articles and make them available as widely as possible to scholars and to readers. They haven't yet seen any erosion in their subscriptions, but from most scholarly societies operate on, at least in the humanities, on a very tight financial margin and worry about any major change in their balance sheet.
Well, please join me again in thanking